Thank you so much, Mary. Is this working all right? Everyone can hear me up there? Sound is good? Well, it's really a pleasure to be here, and in a sense to be back here because I come from University of Toronto. And by training, I'm a computer scientist. I started in the engineering science program here at the University of Toronto, took physics courses, of course, but specialized in computer science, and went on to do a PhD in computer science. But I just couldn't seem to get away from physics over the years. And it seems to keep coming back into my work. So it's a pleasure to share a little bit about that with you. So my area of expertise is computer graphics. And computer graphics allows us to create all these kinds of amazing images. Here we have a preservation of Michelangelo's David, a scene from a movie, and a visualization of a building that's never been built yet. And of course, to make these visualizations, one of the first things that people in computer graphics had to think about was light transport, and how does light reflect off different surfaces, how to model the bouncing between the various scattering and material properties as light transports. That's not where I'm going to go today. I'm going to comment that all of these images are frozen in time. And so one of the next things that we had to worry about in computer graphics was how to get things moving. Now, the idea of depicting motion has been around for a long time. Here's probably the earliest recorded animation. It is on a vase, and you see a goat. It's telling the story of a goat that's jumping to get a leaf. And a little later on, this was found in a tomb. And this shows a sort of wrestling match. Maybe it's saying something about what happened to this person, or maybe the person just liked wrestling. Now, these are just depictions of motion in sequence. And eventually, people figured out that we can use persistence of vision, the fact that the eye retains an image for some amount of time, to develop various sort of tools that allow us to kind of see an animation visually. And in fact, the tool that I'm showing here, the proxinoscope, was the direct predecessor to modern cinema. In fact, here in Paris is the first proxinoscope that was used with a projection system. These are mirrors right there. And here's the advertisement for the first movie ever. Now, perhaps what we associate most closely with movies is, for example, the early work of Walt Disney with computer animation, with hand-drawn animations and so forth. In fact, Walt's Snow White and the Seven Dwarves was the seventh full-length film that was produced. There were six others. The first one is completely lost, and the others are available, but this is perhaps the most memorable. And the process by which animators at Disney made these movies was literally drawing frame by frame and flipping back and forth between cells or frames. And what was very interesting is that all of these artists were actually not classically trained. They were all newspaper cartoonists. So they had really no idea what they were doing. And so one of the artists, whose name was Art, he said, and did I skip a slide? Yeah, let's stay here. He said, we need to understand physics. We need to understand what's going on. He brought in people who were experts in anatomy. They had informal workshops in their home. And they did all kinds of exercises and very simple understandings of how physical objects behave. And the classic one that carries over to this day and that all animators are still trained with is this flour sack example. So the idea is, with a flour sack, draw the flour sack to express different emotions, different postures, different intentions, different actions. And you see immediately here the most basic thing that animators have to grapple with, which is on the one hand, they have to tell a story, they have to convey emotion. On the other hand, they are not free to roam as widely as they want away from the laws of physics, or they cannot tell it in a compelling way. So here, for example, they have to understand how to put creases in the right place. And in fact, in all these animations, even though hand-drawn ones, artists have to think about all of these different concept. So one of the videos that I like to show at the start of my introduction to computer animation class at Columbia University is a little snippet from Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, and I ask the students to just look for different physical things that are happening, things like inertia, motion of fabric, motion of hair, feelings of weight, and so forth. So let me play you a little snippet of that. They're telling a story, but they have to really convey the weight of the characters. They can cheat a little bit. Right. So that's hand-drawn animation. And we usually go through an exercise of trying to point out all of the things that are going on. Here, what I'll say is that all was well. People kind of were classically trained. They figured out how to do this. And then computers came along and basically broke everything. So let's talk briefly about the birth of computer animation. So at MIT in the 60s, Sutherland had basically built a device that allowed you to touch the screen, and the screen would have a very quickly moving point. And the device, the pen, would have a little light sensor on it, and so it would be able to detect where, by timing, where on the screen is the pen touching. And from that started the birth of computer graphics, the ability of a person to interact with computers. And this is the control room for this first computer system. I have a lot more I can say here, but I'm going to skip ahead, and I'm going to say that, you know, in the 60s also, not only were people interested in computers for scientific applications, but also, you know, the 60s was kind of a groovy time. People were experimenting with all kinds of, you know, substances. And along with that, people started observing that computers could also be used for artistic purposes. And they started experimenting with cellular automata and different mathematical systems for creating images on the screen. Now, this was all kind of stuff on the fringes at first, but very quickly, within the next 20 years, computer graphics became mainstream. Fluid dynamics. So, you know, it was getting into the mainstream. People realize it's going to be around to stay. And maybe the first computer animation in terms of a full-length feature film that was out and that people remember is Disney's Toy Story. And in fact, this was the first full-length feature animation film done on a computer. And today, actually, just by a nice coincidence, at 1 a.m. this morning, Disney just came out with their latest feature animation film, Tangled. So That's Tangled. That's out today. For every one of you that go sees it, I make a dollar, so please go see it. No, actually, I don't. But my group of students and I are very fortunate to be in a situation where we're also interacting with some of the studios as they develop these movies. And some of the technologies that we've developed have made it into Disney's pipeline and are used in Tangle, for example, in the motion of the skirt using equations of motion that I'll talk about a little bit, and in particular in Tangled, the collisions or the contact between layers of the skirt was a real issue. And some of our other work is used in other studios, so I think today the main goal is to kind of give you a little behind-the-scenes taste for what sort of physical ideas do I need to work with or do we need to work with in the animation community as these movies are produced, and then to give you a little taste of how some of the software and numerical methods that we've developed for these purposes have come around and matured to the point where now we're able to use them in collaboration with experimental physicists at various schools in actual physics experiments. So let me skip this for a sec. Let me give you a little bit of propaganda. This is the guiding philosophy that my group uses in approaching these problems. Others use different philosophies, and there's a few other groups that also also subscribe to this philosophy. So here I have orbiting of planets, and the thing we naturally might associate with that is Kepler's second law, which just says that if this is the sun and I have an elliptical orbit, then the swept area is the same for equal intervals of time. And this is a nice geometric observation about the orbit of a physical system. And in fact, the earliest proof for Kepler's second law came from Newton's Principia. And interestingly enough, or maybe not surprisingly, Newton proved this in the discrete setting. So he assumed piecewise linear trajectories of the planet and instantaneous impulses from the sun every equal interval of time. And if I bring up a simple modern reproduction of the same diagram, then basically what Newton argued, and I won't walk through this now, is that it's very easy to show by just similarity of triangles that the area of these triangles is the same as you go around this elliptical or discrete elliptical orbit. And a modern reinterpretation of that same proof just rewrites it in terms of a numerical method for integrating forward F equals MA in time, integrating an ODE numerically. And in fact, this method is called symplectic Euler, and you can show that it's identical to several other methods that exist, but here's what I want to convey about this. On this side is symplectic Euler. On this side is explicit Euler. Explicit Euler is the most simple numerical method that we teach in a first-year numerical methods class. Just take the position is equal to the old position plus elapsed time times the momentum. Well, you know, you need mass in there. And then you need momentum is old momentum plus elapsed time times the forces acting. And symplectic Euler is virtually identical, except that the forces are evaluated at the end of the step instead of at the beginning of the step. What I want to emphasize, and it's very important, is that there are all kinds of numerical methods for integrating forward an ODE. And you can always find the trade-off between computational cost versus the quality of such a method. In this case, I want to emphasize that both of these have equal computational cost, but they have very different performance. In fact, if you look at the orbit generated by explicit Euler, it kind of goes off to Alpha Centauri if you just run the program for long enough. And if you look at the orbit for symplectic Euler, well, the dotted line here is the correct trajectory, and you see that it deviates, but qualitatively it retains the right shape of an orbit, all right? So the reason for this is because symplectic Euler, in essence, has Kepler's law built into the definition of the algorithm, of the time-stepping rule. whereas explicit Euler does not. This means that even if we execute the algorithm using large intervals of time or large time steps, we will get reasonable facsimiles of an orbit if we use a method like symplectic Euler. And this is important, of course, for things like computer animation, where we're not necessarily interested always in a predictive result so much as a qualitatively correct result. Then we can rely on integrators or methods that have geometric structure, such as Kepler's second law, built into the algorithms, so that even if we run far from the resolutions and supercomputers needed for very accurate predictive computational physics, we can still retain the characteristic structure, characteristic behavior that comes out of the underlying geometric principles for these models. And by the way, you can also show that if you look at the global error in the trajectory as a function of time, that symplectic Euler has a, this is the energy behavior. Symplectic Euler, the global error in trajectory is below, down here, so let me correct myself. So symplectic Euler has a very nice conservative property. So energy is approximately conserved no matter how long you run this method, whereas explicit Euler, again, the energy blows up just as the orbit blows up. So it's preserving one of the first integrals that we will care about in a typical simulation. It's preserving the Hamiltonian, at least approximately. All right. So that's the propaganda. That's essentially how we approach this work. And I guess we can start to ask, what are the sort of things that we look for if we're trying to animate fabric for an animated character? Well, one of the things that we drew inspiration from is Chladni's ancient vibrating plate experiment, where some sawdust is sprinkled on a polygonal shape that's fixed at the middle, and the shape is vibrated, for example, with a violin bow, and of course, all the sawdust settles on the nodal lines, right? The lines that don't vibrate. And in fact, the Academy of Science in Paris offered a kilogram of gold to the person who would explain these patterns that are being formed. And no one answered it correctly in 1808. In 1811, there was an entry that was almost correct, and it was revised. And Monsieur Leblanc, which was the pen name for Sophie Germain, one of the great female mechanicians, and in essence, the mother of modern elasticity theory, proposed a model for why this is happening. And we were inspired by Sophie's argument because essentially it boiled down to looking at geometric structure, looking at symmetries in the system. So she said, we're looking at vibration, so we should expect that the stored energy is some function of the principal curvatures of the surface. And then by logic such as orientation invariance, it doesn't matter if we have normals pointing up or pointing down. By isotropy, by bending as a change of embedding, she gave certain properties for that this energy must hold, and then she asked for the simplest possible energy that satisfied all these properties, and that was integral of mean curvature squared over the surface. And integral of mean curvature squared over the surface is invariant under the entire Mobius group of transformations, including rigid motions, uniform scaling, and then, of course, by another famous mathematician and mechanician, Noether, we know that if we have these invariants in our Lagrangian formulation, then we have associated conservation laws. So the name of the game here is to come up with a discretization of Sophie Germain's energy that retains these same invariants so that the discrete formulation and the corresponding algorithms also have conservation of angular momentum, conservation of momentum, and so forth. So one of the earliest models we proposed, and I won't go into it today, I'll just say that it essentially represented any surface, any fabric, as a mesh of triangles. And then it said that the simplest possible bending model has to use two triangles because that's where you can actually see some curvature. And then we essentially carried over all of Sophie Germain's logic to the discrete case and came up with something that essentially looks like squaring the angle made by the two triangles with appropriate scaling factors. And this has been used in various studios and in various simulations. It can be used not just for animation, but also to model the resting shape of paper. So here's a simulation, if you want, of a paper in a relaxed state. It can be used for origami. And it can be generalized with orthotropic material properties or various more advanced material models to start to do fracture simulations that have more material parameters than just the usual Young's modulus and Poisson's ratio. So that's one thing, just modeling the elastic behavior of a flexible sheet. Now, another thing that I'd like to say is that in the sort of simulations that we're interested in, typically the fabric isn't stretching very much. So here is 10% stretching, 1% stretching, and a strain of 0.1%. And here's a 1 meter by 1 meter piece of denim that was pinned above my bedroom because that's where I had a white wall to take a photo of it, and then I forgot to take it down for like a year and a half. So it was my artwork. And what we see is that this piece of denim most closely matches under the weight of gravity, it stretches less than 1%. Now, traditionally, the way people model fabric and clothing is fabric is typically constructed by having strings woven in a warp and weft direction, two perpendicular directions. So it may be very natural to have some set of points and connect them by some set of edges, and then use some springs to resist stretching across the edges. Well, it turns out that if you don't want the fabric to stretch a lot, you have to make the springs stiffer and stiffer and stiffer. And if you've worked with any numerical methods in the past, you know that as you create, well, just the simple intuition is as you make the spring stiffer and stiffer, of course, the natural frequency of oscillation goes higher and higher. So any numerical integration method needs to resolve this with smaller and smaller time steps, or you need to use other kinds of implicit integration methods that filter away these oscillations. And one of the tricky things to do here is how do you critically damp a network of nonlinear springs? But essentially, it's the wrong model if you're interested in something that doesn't stretch. Stiff springs is not the right way to go. So what we looked at was a constrained Lagrangian mechanics formulation. So if this is all of configuration space of a piece of fabric, and this dashed curve there represents the subspace of all inextensible or isometric deformations of the piece of fabric, then the simulation proceeds something like this. First, there's a step forward in time that is due only to external forces, gravity, momentum, and so forth. And then there is a projection back onto the space of inextensible deformation. So it's a two-step sort of thing. Step, and then project back onto the inextensible space. One of the reasons why it's important to truly enforce that fabric isn't stretching is because when fabric doesn't stretch and you push on it, it has to buckle. And that buckling creates the wrinkles and folds that we're expecting to see. So by using this sort of formulation, we're able to have garments that have a lot of lively motion and wrinkles and folds on them. This rendering here was in collaboration with a company in Israel called Optitex. Optitex makes the software that is used all over the world by Reebok, by BMW, by all of the big clothing and automotive manufacturers for design of textiles, either for clothing or for upholstery. So, of course, they're interested in seeing how certain designs will look. Okay, another thing that we do in our work is we use adaptive computation to steer the computer towards focusing on the interesting details. So this is a snapshot from my PhD dissertation where we simulated the thin shell equations, and in particular we were simulating rapid inflation of an airbag, approximately 2 milliseconds. And you can see that there are some very smooth regions and there are some regions with a lot of oscillations. So it doesn't make sense to allocate the computation equally throughout. So we have a metric where the program is constantly monitoring the strain in the system, the curvature in the system. And then during simulation, each of these points corresponds to a degree of freedom of the simulation, and they're adaptively added or refined to focus where wrinkles are forming. Now, of course, there's a kind of interesting problem there, a kind of chicken and the egg problem, because if you don't refine sufficiently in some part of the surface that should have a wrinkle developing, then there won't be enough degrees of freedom in the simulation for this wrinkle to develop, right? So you want to code these things up in such a way that the choice of where you're refining does not influence the course of the physical system. And that's the challenge there. That's basically sums up at a high level, at a very caricaturistic level, the sort of considerations that we're looking at with the computation of the dynamics of fabric. But a very big challenge is how we handle contact between fabric. Right now I'm wearing a sweater, a shirt, and I could be wearing more layers. And for us, it's pretty clear that things don't go through each other. But of course, in a computer system, unless you insert forces for that or handle that in some way, everything just goes through everything else and it doesn't look very good. So here's some things that don't look very good. So these are kind of problem cases where we're taking a piece of cloth and we're shoving it through a funnel. And I'm going to play it again. And on, And on the left, we're going to see that some of the cloth leaks outside of the funnel. And on the right, we're going to see that some of the cloth gets jammed and stuck in the funnel. And so the ball that is prescribed to move down starts to stretch the funnel, starts to stretch the cloth. So what am I talking about here? I think I need to pause for a second, and I think my video is not going to allow me to do that. So let me do that for just a second. If you throw infinite computation at this particular problem, you can get it right. So if you, for example, set up some forces, some repulsive forces between the fabric and itself, and throw enough compute power at the problem, you can get it right. But you can't get it right at the speeds that studios need in order to crank out results and at the speeds that artists need in order to see whether they like the simulation, revise it, and start again. So for that reason, in computer science, computer graphics, we've looked for what kind of approximations can be made to these physical systems in order to get faster computation times. And what I'm showing here is that some of these approximations aren't very good. So one of them is handle contact between the fabric and itself separately from contact between the fabric and the funnel. That's shown on that side. And of course, if you handle them separately, you will get some leakage of the fabric outside of the funnel. On the other side, we're showing another approximation that's typically made. And it's the following. Suppose you have N-way interactions between contact forces. You have a jammed situation with a lot of fabric inside a small region. There are a lot of possible interactions. You can solve this using techniques such as linear complementarity problems. They're not numerically stable for very complex systems. So what's done here is very often people just execute some number of iterations between pairs, with not accounting for other pairs, and as a consequence, the system never converges, and you can't prove that it'll ever converge. So then people bail out, and they say, after I've done some number of pairwise collisions, if the system hasn't converged and there are still some penetrations, let me approximate the whole thing as a rigid body. And that rigid body approximation is good because if you had some piece of fabric that before was not interpenetrating and you've taken a step forward in time and now it is interpenetrating, going back and treating the whole piece of fabric as a rigid body is one way to guarantee that none of the fabric has moved relative to other pieces of the fabric. It's bad because the fabric can jam in the funnel because it's too rigid. So on that side, we're seeing the jamming, and that's why you start to see stretching on the bottom, is because it's jammed in there. And on this side, we're seeing some of the leakage. Now in the next animation, we're showing the method that Disney is using right now, and the idea here is that instead, if you find that you need to give up on doing iterations of impulses between pairs, pieces of the fabric, then what you do is you solve a linear system that allows that only kills relative velocity between the objects, but allows for smoothly sliding tangential motion. And this is what they used in order to allow the garment to have a lot of layers of fabric on top of each other. Now, an interesting thing here is that when you start to make these approximations, you have to ask, have you destroyed a lot of the physical behavior you're interested in? For example, can you still model coefficients of friction? So here we're showing that the... Oh, I lost it. Let me try one more time. If not, I'll just skip it. Okay. So here we're showing that the model that's being used at Disney right now can handle different coefficients of friction. And in particular, you get interesting phase shifts in the pattern that's formed on the bottom as these pieces of ribbon slide down. So you started with an alternating set of loops, and as you keep increasing the coefficient of friction, you get these nice nested loops. Okay. Now, I mentioned that in each of these problems, we're looking for what is the important structure to preserve when we move to the discrete setting. And while I just showed you one thing that was done as an approximation for a movie, we're also fundamentally interested in how to get the physics right on these things. And one of the interesting cases that was explored by Danny Kaufman and his colleagues at University of British Columbia and at Rutgers, and then Danny, after doing this work, moved and became a postdoc in my lab, was what is the physics of getting a house of cards to stand up? So here is the normal forces and frictional forces in a house of cards. And the interesting and important thing to note here is that friction, of course, and contact are fundamentally coupled. They're a coupled problem. But in the house of cards, it's critical. So as you have gravity pushing down on this thing, you have a normal force. And the cards start sliding this way, unless there's static friction. So there's static friction, which acts in that direction. Acting in that direction on a rigid body induces a torque, and that torque pushes the card deeper into the ground, thereby increasing the normal force, and there's a cycle there. So it's important in simulating these dynamics to get the coupling between friction and contact. And here's what happens. So here's an actual experiment that Danny carried out to show that a house of cards structure is fairly stable. He used roughened pieces of metal so that there would be a relatively high coefficient of friction. And here's what happens if you use algorithms that do not do the right coupling between friction and contact. The house of cards is completely not stable, right? And that's the state of the art. And some of the work that Danny has developed is known as staggered projections, and it essentially is an implementation of a coupled set of variational principles, a maximum dissipation principle, a friction principle, and a contact principle combined together with an efficient algorithm to solve it. One of the neat things that comes out of getting good treatment of friction and contact is you can start to reproduce a lot of the sort of phenomena that we see in real life. Now, we may not see a chair dancing like this, but we are definitely used to stick-slip behavior. That's exactly what happens when you hear screeching of a chalk on a chalkboard. It's exactly the sort of motion like the chair right there. Okay, so that's contact. Now I want to talk to you a little bit about elastic rods. So here's a computation of a Kirchhoff elastic rod. Those who attended yesterday's talk know some of the mathematical background behind this. But basically, we developed a model for Kirchhoff elastic rods. And this model is used at Weta Digital. This is the studio that made Avatar and made Lord of the Rings. And they're using it for various things. I guess you can guess what from here. So here's a little test they did with this model where they just took some hair and made it go through an obstacle course to see how it behaves. And here's a simulation as of a year ago that was just a test simulation for them. Okay, and the underlying geometric structure, so we had Kepler's law in one case, and we had coupled principles for friction in another case, and we had Sophie Germain's axiomatic view of elastica in another case. In this case, the underlying geometry that we're interested in is that of parallel transport of a frame along a curve. I won't spend a lot of time on this today, but I will say if you have an elastic rod, you need to model both the position of the curve and the material distributed along the curve. And there's a direct analogy between the statics of an elastic rod held at both ends to the dynamics of a spinning top that's not allowed to slide at the bottom, that only processes about one point. And the structure that we had to carry over from the smooth to the discrete case was that of a twist-free frame, which corresponds, if you will, to putting a bead on a wire and pushing it and letting it go inertially. All right, and it's a frictionless wire, so the bead is not going to do any more turning than it needs to in order to follow the wire. Just a rigid body motion. And that's the structure that we had to carry over to the discrete case. And here's the motion of a bead along a piecewise linear wire. Now, besides Weta using this code, it's also found in the current version of Photoshop. So let me see if I can briefly pull up a demo of that. So if you use Photoshop these days, and you load it up, this is just the off-the-shelf Photoshop. There's now a paintbrush in it. And this paintbrush is running a physical simulation under the hood. And here I'm showing you the simulation right there. It's just the brush, but you can see the paint deposition model and you can see the action of all of the bristles. And somewhere on here, there's ways of changing the material properties, making it stiffer and so forth, but I'm not going to spend any time on that right now. Okay, so this was all fine, this was all fun. Now the question is, can any of these ideas be carried over beyond the glitz and glamour of Hollywood, beyond consumer products like Photoshop? So the idea, of course, is that innovation or scientific discovery happens in a cycle, and sometimes you can replace an experiment with computation. Of course, the computation has to be predictive. Here's a simulation that we conducted of the crushing of a cylinder, and it's in a simulation, you can run perfectly controlled environments. So you can really start with a symmetric shape, right, and introduce only tiny asymmetries if you like, and you can push exactly straight down, and you see this formation of these beautiful diamond patterns. And if you crush a Coke can, and you were able to crush straight down and just at the right speed, you would see these patterns. But of course, in general, you see some grossly distorted version of them. However, in a lab, if you do this carefully, you can indeed see the formation of these patterns. So if the computations can be predictive, then they can have applications beyond special effects and so forth. So for example, the elastic rods model that I just showed you in Photoshop and in hair simulation is also being used by researchers at Berkeley and UNC Chapel Hill and Johns Hopkins who are interested in simulating the movement of steerable needles. These are needles that are used to perform various operations, such as depositing a little radioactive pellet or doing a biopsy. And the idea is that these needles can steer around delicate organs. How? They have a beveled tip, and therefore, as they are inserted, there is a differential pressure, and so they start turning in one direction, and the end of the needle that is outside the patient can be twisted, thus turning the direction of the tip, and in that way you can steer the needle. As you can imagine, that's really hard to control, so they need training tools in order to do this, and that's what these scientists have developed. And also, ideally, you would like robotic controllers, which means that the robot has to be able to predict what is the outcome of the motion of the needle in order to plan a path. So they're using the elastic rods model there. The elastic rods model is also used by Basile Adoli in the Institut d'Alembert at the University of Paris 6. He was looking at knots and the twisting of knots. And here we see that depending on the direction in which you twist a knot, you get one of two characteristic stable configurations, and it's being reproduced by the model. And currently, we're looking at the applications of the elastic rod model together with Pedro Rice at MIT. Pedro was just in the news, I think, last Friday for a science article on how cats drink. So that's there. And Pedro is interested in basically taking phenomena that are happening at very large or very tiny scales and remapping them to desktop scales. And here he's looking at essentially the coiling of spaghetti. You drop some spaghetti, or in this case some cable, on the floor, and you see what happens. So here's a ship that's dropping cable on the ocean floor, and they want to understand, how does it get deposited? Does it meander? Does it go in a straight line? Does it coil? Does it get knotted up? And here's something at completely the other end of the scale. This is nanometer scale, and there's interest in designing essentially passive systems for depositing various patterns onto a substrate. So here you drop some cable at nanoscale from a certain height, and you want to know what sort of pattern does it form. So Pedro has been doing these experiments in his lab on a desktop scale, and I think this is a neat example of how simulation can also inform science. So he was doing these actual experiments, and he was observing that as this cable drops on the ground, it perverts. And it perverts in a regular pattern. And he was also, so every few turns it switches direction. And he was also looking at moving belt experiments and so forth. I don't have time to talk about that. What I will say is that I'm proud to say that our simulations were not able to reproduce his experimental results. Why am I proud to say such a thing? Because we checked very carefully every one of the parameters, material properties, thickness, friction, everything against what he was using. Everything matched up, and we weren't able to reproduce the results. And we said, is there possibly a parameter we're neglecting, something we're overlooking? And we said, no. And Pedro said, no, everything looks good. There's nothing else we should be accounting for. And My student, who was working for Weta at the time, said, well, could it be that maybe the cable is naturally curved a little bit? And we said, no, that shouldn't matter. Okay, so the student went to Weta and worked on hair stuff. And as a side thing, he just gave the elastic rod and the code a little bit of natural curvature. And sure enough, it started perverting direction. So he played only with a parameter for natural curvature of the rod until he matched the frequency observed in the video. And I sent Pedro an email and I said, Pedro, by any chance are you storing your cables on a spool of such and such diameter? And less than 1% error. So there is a simulation, right? A very simple simulation that is essentially saying to the physicists, hey, here's something you shouldn't neglect. If you take this out of the equation, you won't see what you're seeing. And that's something that can be done in a very controlled way when you have a simulation. You can rip out components, you can zero out terms, you can add other terms. So that's kind of neat. I have to wrap up in about 5 minutes, is that right? Okay, so let me wrap up with this stuff. So here we have not ropes now coiling, but viscous threads or viscous fluids. And of course, you know, this is of interest in a lot of applications, the folding of lava, the manufacturing of non-woven textiles. A third of all worldwide textile production is done by some molten polymer that flies out of some spinning drum with a few tiny holes in it, and it dries up and looks like those patterns up there. And that's what you find in baby diapers and surgical masks. And here at the University of Toronto, in fact, one of my hosts, Stephen Morris, conducted some pretty amazing experiments that show that if you drop a viscous thread onto a moving belt, then just depending on the belt speed, you can get any number of amazing patterns. And I think that's great because I'm going to use that to decorate cupcakes without having to move my hand, right? I just have to know the height and the speed at which to move, right? But, you know, other people want to use this for stretchable electronics or other things like that. So we took the elastic rods model. And one of the neat things you can do in simulation is you can really quickly reconfigure things. And we were able to take the elastic rods model, and with only a few very simple changes, basically adding surface tension and basically replacing strain by strain rate, because that's the Rayleigh analogy between elastic and viscous materials, we were able to immediately get these sort of simulations that you see here. And qualitatively, you see some nice agreement with the experimental results. And we were able to validate some things for the surface tension model as well. Here's a blob of fluid being placed between two stationary blocks. And depending on how much fluid you put in between, you either get that gravity dominates or you get that surface tension dominates. And when surface tension dominates, you get a completely different behavior, like a U-shape that breaks apart. And again, there's qualitative agreement, and there's also a nice phase transition. But in the end, all we want to do is do things to the bunny, right? So there's a long tradition in computer graphics that whenever you publish a paper, it has to involve this bunny, and something has to be done to the bunny. The teapot is for rendering. Should I give me a time frame, because I could wrap up in 1 minute or in 2 minutes. Okay. So let me end with this. Let me skip a couple things. And let me just say that one of the things that a natural transition perhaps between this viscous fluids is these other applications of simulations of fluids. And here's Yostam. Yostam is a graduate of Eugene Fiume, who is a graphics professor here at the University of Toronto. Yostam did his PhD here, and he got his Academy Award for his work on doing computational fluid dynamics for the movies. And here the name of the game is, how can you take the biggest possible steps in time and still have stable fluid dynamics? So here he's running real-time fluids on an iPad, right? And so there's all kinds of applications of that. So I just wanted to mention that because I think that just kind of shows that, you know, there's a long tradition of computer graphics work and computational physics work within computer graphics right here at the University of Toronto, just a couple buildings away from you. Now, in my case, I just want to say that, of course, I didn't do almost any of this. It's always my students who are doing this and the stormtrooper. And I just want to thank you very much for your time and attention.